It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We learn about scientists using digital devices to decode the hidden world of non-human sound and the surprising things they're hearing. This is a dive into bioacoustics, the science of listening to non-human organisms. And when we tune into nature's sounds, really listen with help from algorithms as well, it's possible to build dictionaries in the languages of African elephant, Australian dolphin, or sperm whalish. What could a two-way conversation be like with non-humans? Join in, 800-642-1234. Karen Bakker is a professor of environmental studies and geography at the University of British Columbia. Her book is called The Sounds of Life, How Digital Technology is Bringing Us Closer to the Worlds of Animals and Plants. Karen, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thanks for having me.
Well, we humans have created thousands of different languages and have been making music for thousands of years. But you tell us that compared to other animals, humans are really poor listeners. What are we missing in the natural world?
So most sounds made in nature either occur above our hearing range or below our hearing range. And those sounds are inaudible to us. So above the upper end of our hearing range, you have the ultrasonic. That's where dolphins and bats and also rodents communicate. Plants make ultrasound. We cannot hear it, but lots of animals can. At the other end of our hearing range, below the lower end of our hearing range, is the infrasonic. And that's the realm of elephants and whales and tigers, beavers, thunder, tornadoes. The planet makes a lot of infrasound. If you had this hearing range, you would actually be able to hear like the drumming heartbeat of our planet that's made by ocean waves crashing on continental shelves. So a lot of that is audible to other species, but not to us.
And with technology, then, we're able to hear the drumming of our planet. Can you explain the impact that bioacoustics is having?
Yeah, so the art of listening to nature has a long and venerable tradition, of course. But in the past 10 years, something has changed. And that is the digitization of bioacoustics. And bioacoustics is the science of listening to living organisms and to the world around us. So the technologies that scientists and amateurs are now using are portable. They are smaller than the average smartphone. They're cheap. You can make DIY devices. Literally, there's one called the Audio Moth that is open source. You can order it online, order the parts online, build it yourself for less than $100. And you too can head out and listen to nature. And the miniaturization of these components and the fact they're cheap, automated, portable, means that scientists are now installing digital listening devices everywhere on the planet, from the depths of the ocean, the highest mountaintops, from the Arctic to the Amazon. And now we have sort of like a planetary scale hearing aid, and we're able to listen beyond our limited human hearing range.
And I would add that these devices are waterproof. I was really fascinated about, you know, the underwater, the marine bioacoustics, and marine animals being able to hear much farther than they can see. What is it like, below the surface of the water?
Yeah, so under the water, sound travels farther than light. So most aquatic creatures rely on a sense of sound rather than a sense of vision. Or let's say their sense of hearing is much better than their sense of vision. What this means is that they see the world through sound. They're highly sonically attuned. Some of the most powerful underwater communicators your audience probably knows about, like whales that can dive deep into the ocean to something called the sofar channel. It's about a half mile under the surface. And there, if you broadcast sound, it can travel hundreds or even thousands of miles. A whale singing off the coast of Bermuda can be heard off the coast of Ireland. Mm-hmm. So sound is everywhere in the ocean. A lot more creatures make sound than we realize. And that's one of the amazing things that all of these digital listening devices have uncovered.
Karen Bakker with us, author of The Sounds of Life, as we talk about humans overlooking the role of sound in nature. You can join in the conversation at 800-642-1234. Karen, let's go more deeply on whales, because humans were unaware of whale songs until recent decades. Why do whales sing?
So Western scientists and Western culture was unaware of whale song, but indigenous cultures were well aware of whale song. And in the first two chapters of the book, I explore the kind of scientific odyssey whereby the Inupiat in Alaska taught Western scientists how to hear the songs of whales that they had long listened to and were intimately familiar with. So this story is a bit of a story about Western science and Western culture being hard of hearing and not being able to listen to things that other cultures had long known. Now, whales are a beautiful example of sound in nature. They sing for a variety of reasons. One reason, and that is extremely well known, is mating songs, these beautiful, complex structures that we think enable groups to define their territory, express some sense of culture, because whales have culture. Those songs are taught from elders to young within whale communities. They innovate with their songs. We can track new songs that are born in one community and then travel across entire oceans, sometimes rapidly. It's kind of like a pop song, you know, a number one hit. Literally, whales are trading culture, trading songs, trading ideas. So we are aware of those songs because they're a powerful and mesmerizing expression of whale culture. But there's lots of other communication happening. Whales, in some cases, are using language to navigate, using sound, echolocation to find prey, literally see underwater, a bit like ultrasound is used in medical devices for us. In other cases, they're using sound to protect one another. So when right whales give birth, the mothers whisper to their babies, keeping them very quiet so they don't attract predators.
Wow.
Yeah, we know. And beyond that, you know, amazing dolphins, of course, we've studied long for many decades and know they use sound in incredible ways. Dolphins even have individual names. They will come when they are called with those names.
I think it's time to hear some sound, because as you talk about this, let's more fully listen. And you mentioned how bowhead whales are the jazz singers. So here's a recording of bowhead whales made by the Norwegian Polar Institute, made available by the Washington Post. There's something so haunting in that as well. What do you hear?
So for a long time, scientists assumed those songs were songs without words and approached them as music. That idea itself, by the way, was very controversial. When a scientific power couple, Roger and Katie Payne, discovered whale song, which had actually sort of been a classified military secret for much of the 20th century, they published what became the best-selling nature album of all time and went platinum, called Whale Song, published their findings in leading scientific journals like Science, and claimed that because those songs were so complex and beautiful, they were actually music. Katie was a classically trained musician. She even learned a lot of the whale songs and she channeled whale. She does great whale imitations to this day. But the next generation of research is now analyzing these songs to see if they actually have semantic content, if they have meaning, if they have the equivalent to symbols or abstract concepts or even words. And that is the kind of next breakthrough in research on whales, and not only bowheads or humpbacks, but even whales like sperm whales. They're all very different. Sperm whale sound is much more like Morse code, knocking, rapping, tapping. If they were to make a loud noise next to you, they could blow out your eardrums. They are such powerful vocalizers, they could literally vibrate you to death. So we can't, you know, easily decode all one whale language and then decode them all. But scientists are now attempting to essentially build dictionaries in these different whale languages.
Environmental studies and geography professor Karen Bakker, our guide as we explore this universal importance of sound for living organisms and how our languages could be adapted to communicate with whales, non-humans. Join in on digital bioacoustics, echolocation, the symphonies of the underwater world, and what they say about intelligence, about communication. 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're in conversation with University of British Columbia geographer and Guggenheim Fellow Karen Bakker, who studies the implications of digital technologies on environmental sustainability and the future of non-human communication. Her new book is called The Sounds of Life, and it introduces us to scientists who are in touch with this vast array of species, hearing them in new ways that are just beginning to, you know, we're able to decipher and decode. Join in on whale songs, bee dances, turtle communication, and more. 800-642-1234. Let's go to Tina in Green Bay. Tina, hi. What would you like to bring up?
Good morning. So this past spring, my daughters and I had the good fortune to be able to go to Maui for a week, and we were snorkeling right at kind of the end of the whale season in Maui, and we were with a group of people, and we could actually hear underwater. We could hear the whales as we were snorkeling. And it was just such a very surreal thing to hear. It was amazing. So, and I didn't realize you could actually hear that when we were under the water. So that was very cool. And one other thing, you know, the sound of just like falling leaves in the fall, if you get a really nice, quiet day, but the leaves are falling, they just like sing and dance as they fall. And it's very it's just a very amazing sound as well.
Oh, Tina, what did that do to you? What did your guide say? How in the moment were you feeling? Oh, Tina, can you still hear us? I guess she's not there. Karen, what do you make of that as Tina was snorkeling and able to hear the sounds?
Well, attuning ourselves to the sounds of nature is often a profound experience. The ability of whale song to travel across long distances means that the ocean is actually alive with sound, and not just whales. I mean, shrimp make noise, fish, coral. The coral reefs are really noisy places. In an era of modern, you know, machines and engines, we tend to tune out those sounds. And so there's a very uncanny feeling when we stop to listen. And I heard that in Tina's voice. And what I loved next was she said, even the sound of leaves falling, many of the sounds made in nature are very subtle, very quiet. They kind of require, you know, like a little moment of pause, like a body held in stillness. And all of a sudden you're hearing things that maybe you had just sort of filtered out. What I love about digital technologies is they enable us to do that for lots of other species that we previously thought were mute. We were previously deaf to. And once you start realizing that everything in nature is actually making sound and receptive to sound, including plants, and this is based on robust science, the book surveys over 1,000 articles by over 4,000 scientists. Once you realize it, that there's this whole sort of symphony ongoing all around us, nature's in continuous conversation, it really changes your worldview. It really, I don't know, special feeling in your heart.
When you talk about deaf and mute, let's look at turtles, because some reference books had thought turtles don't make sound. Can you explain how scientists finally realized that turtles do make noise?
Yeah, that's absolutely right. So for much of the 20th century, scientists that study turtles, they're called herpetologists, by the way, fun fact, they assumed turtles barely made noise, maybe only, you know, in the throes of agony if they were dying. And then there were two very young, brave researchers, Julia Giles in Australia and Camila Ferrara in Brazil, that actually in the field had heard turtles making noise. They were disbelieved. They were laughed at by their scientific colleagues, told they would never get their PhDs, but they persisted. And they were the researchers that basically revolutionized our understanding of turtles. Turtles make lots of noise. It's very soft. It's very low frequency. It's very polite. And by polite, I mean, they wait a long time taking turns as they talk. So if you aren't listening very carefully and quietly, you're not going to hear them. But once you tune in, they're making an abundance of sound. Like South American river turtles, these huge giant turtles you've probably seen pictures of, they make hundreds of different sounds. And the cool thing is that baby turtles even make sound in their eggs before they hatch. Camila Ferrara's work showed that turtles are making noise as embryos, calling to one another through their shells to coordinate the moment of their birth. Who knew? And the mother turtles, which scientists assumed just laid the eggs and left, actually are in the water nearby, calling to their babies, guiding them into the water, and then swimming with them to show them safe places to hide away from predators. First evidence of parental care in turtles, overturning our assumptions about that species.
That is absolutely remarkable, so remarkable. Karen Bacher is with us on how sound is being heard, animals and plants, and how they respond. Karen, a fellow at the Harvard Radcliffe Institute for Advanced Study, author of The Sounds of Life. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Karen, you had this just heartbreaking passage that I would really love for you to read to us, because it explores how European colonists feasted on nesting turtles in the Amazon. Would you read some of this passage for us?
Yes, and I'll give a little bit of background.
Please.
So, yeah, the experience of colonization in the Amazon was one in which certain species were decimated, much like the buffalo on the Western Plains. Turtles, because they were an easy source of meat and cash, you could turn the turtle eggs into butter, became a target, and they were slaughtered in the millions. And I'm not exaggerating, literally millions and millions of eggs and turtles, to the point where before they were incredibly abundant. You'd see thousands of turtles hauled out on all the Amazonian beaches. Early colonial counts talk about just seeing like an ocean of turtles. And now they're very highly endangered. They're very hard to find. And so the researchers who study these turtles have to work really hard to find them. And this raises, you know, a broader question about the evolution of our thinking about these animals and about, you know, Western approaches to nature. So with that, here's the passage. The Western scientific discovery of turtle sound began with one turtle quietly roaring its distress in the bottom of Jacqueline Giles's canoe. Earlier generations of Westerners also dealt with turtles in canoes, but less gently. When the turtle hunters of the expanding colonial Amazonian frontier loaded mother turtles into canoes, they reserved a few empty boats. While the mothers waited, pinned helplessly on their backs, the men dug up their eggs and then crushed them by the thousands. The empty canoes became cooking pots. The mixture of dead turtle hatchlings, yolk, and albumen was doused with water and left in the sun. As the yolk fat rose to the surface, it was skimmed off, boiled, and then stored in clay pots. While waiting for the fat to render, the men would roast alive any remaining hatchlings. The mothers would have listened helplessly to the sounds of their babies being killed. They might have cried out to their children, Perhaps their children called back. Perhaps the hunters didn't hear them, or perhaps they heard but didn't care. Perhaps we choose to deafen ourselves not only physically, but also psychologically and spiritually in order to enact the violence of colonization and environmental destruction. Each generation has its silences at which later generations can only wonder.
Thank you. University of British Columbia, Karen Bakker. We'll pick this up. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We learn about digital tools to help translate the non-human world, including discoveries in bee swarm communication. Cornell University biologist Thomas Seeley was on our show in 2019, a renowned expert on bees, and he said at the time, there are many signals bees have that he has no clue as to what they mean.
These are conspicuous ones where a bee will walk over and grab another bee and grab the comb and then make this sound that goes on for about 2 seconds. It goes, I have no idea what that is, for example.
Join in on communicating with the non-human world, 800-642-1234. The book is called The Life of Sounds, and Environmental Studies and Geography Professor Karen Bakker stays with us. Karen, I'm so excited to talk about bees with you. What do scientists understand about how they communicate?
So bees are amazing creatures, and scientists have now documented a few hundred sounds that bees make. We don't know what all of them mean, as Thomas Seeley was saying. We know some of them, though. For example, bees have a stop signal. If one bee makes that sound in the hive, the other bees will stop moving. They also, of course, have their famous waggle dance, which is an intricate sort of figure eight pattern that is danced over and over, which bees will use to tell one another the location of a nectar source. And what's cool about that dance is that the duration and the specific way the bees are waggling, so their abdomen has 6 degrees of freedom, they can make all these very subtle movements. They also are positioning their body in a certain way to gravity and to the angle of the sun, because they can see polarized light, like talk about complicated. Mm. That waggle dance can tell bees where to go to find a nectar source miles away. In some of the experiments they've done, these nectar sources have been literally the other side of a mountain, and bees have been able to find it using this language. Now, what digital bioacoustics adds to this picture is an ability to record many of those sounds and then to train artificial intelligence algorithms to find patterns in those sounds. So much like voice recognition software used for humans or natural language processing, that is what powers Google Translate, we can be using similar AI algorithms on honeybee language, mapping those to also computer vision that's watching what the bees do as they make each sound. And that is enabling us to go much faster, to decode honeybee language and to build a dictionary in honeybee language.
They've also built these robo bees trying to mimic a real bee in order to understand more what's going on in the hive and understand the swarms. How effective are these fake bees in trying to crack the code?
Yeah, Tim Landgraf, who's a researcher in Berlin, has built this amazing and slightly terrifying robotic bee. So what that bee can do, if you go watch the video, it is a Black Mirror come to life. So the bee enters the hive, and it is encoded with specific signals, like the stop signal. The bees will listen to the robot. If the robot says stop, they will stop. Even more impressive, the bee can do a waggle dance and tell the other bees, the robotic bee can tell the bees where to find a new nectar source that they didn't previously know about. They'll pay rapt attention to the dance that the robot is doing, and then they'll go off and check it out. And sure enough, there's some nectar there. So we have broken the barrier of interspecies communication with honeybees. Now, you and I, we cannot vibrate our bodies like a bee. Their language is vibrational and positional and sonic. It's very complicated. We cannot do that, but our computers and our robots can. And scientists are using the same idea to try to develop interspecies communication devices with lots of other species, including bats, dolphins, and whales.
What are the implications then if robo-bees are effective in their communication? You talk about smart hives, and this could be a digital transformation to the world of beekeeping. What are the possibilities?
Yeah, so some of the possibilities seem fairly benign. You can create a smart hive. It's a bit like a smart city. The hive has robots embedded in it. So when the bees colonize the hive, they're going to accept that robot as just part of the landscape. That bee could learn a lot about the honeybees. Each hive has a different dialect, believe it or not. So the honeybee robot could learn the dialect of that hive. And that could enable us to understand a lot more about honeybee social lives. It could enable us to figure out why so many bees are dying. We've had this huge die-off of the domesticated honeybee species, and that has been a huge worry because they're such important pollinators for us. So we could help them. We could help them maybe by telling them, you know, avoid this area. It's not a good place to go to for food. It might make you sick, or direct them to other safe areas for nectar. Now, all of this is, though, slightly uncanny and perhaps worrisome, because it also allows us to further domesticate honeybees. And we do have to think about what safeguards are in place so that these technologies aren't manipulative or in some way used for ends that we wouldn't think of as humane. So that's now stimulating a huge debate in the scientific community.
We're talking about how humans are beginning to better understand the sounds around us in the natural world. Karen Bakker, our guide professor at the University of British Columbia and author of The Sounds of Life. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Karen, you know, as we do crack these codes, what is the ethical tension there to, you know, help us navigate this new world of understanding with these digitally enabled, you know, interspecies communication? Because we can help species in the face of biodiversity loss, but there's also a darker side to that. Can you explain the tensions?
Yeah, I mean, one concern is the long history of militarization of conservation, and there's a history there with dolphins and whales. Honeybees have also actually been used. They've been trained to sense specific smells, for example, stick out their tongues when they smell them, and they're used in live biosensing devices and then cruelly discarded after they're no longer useful. That's a real example. That's not a science fiction example.
Can you explain that more deeply? Because isn't this in weapons shipment? Or explain how that works.
Yeah, it's a military biosensing device. Essentially, there's a bee that's put into a cartridge. The cartridge is inserted into an environmental monitoring device. The bee will react to whatever smell it's been trained to react to. For example, the smell of explosives. The device will pick up the bee's reaction. Let's say it sticks out its proboscis, its tongue, and that will alert whatever individual is carrying the bee biosensor that there's, you know, explosives. The bee is much more sensitive than any device humans can build, and so it can really detect minute quantities of whatever biochemical is of interest. The honeybees, though, are treated as really disposable objects. They're inserted in these cartridges, and then they're disposed of after the end of their lives. So there's a question about humane treatment and whether that is our power to manipulate that species is best used in this way. There are other concerns as well that arise as we start to use these interspecies communication robots. Maybe the animals don't want to speak to us. Shouldn't they be giving consent? We're eavesdropping on them. Do they have a right to privacy? Do they have any rights analogous to the rights that humans have about their data? And right now, those safeguards are not in place. And even more worrisome, you could imagine a kind of non-human version of disinformation or misinformation that's automatically generated by these AI algorithms. There's no protection in place currently to prevent that from happening.
I want to contrast that with the potential power of good in the bioacoustics arena. And you mentioned how the advancements of WhaleSafe and applying digital tools to telling boat captains to slow down so that they don't strike a whale. Can you explain what's happening there in California?
Yeah, there's some amazing work being done using bioacoustics for good. Using bioacoustics, we can track where whales appear in the ocean. The accurate real-time location is broadcast to ship's captains who are required to slow down or even leave the area. On the East Coast in the Atlantic, you have to stop fishing if you hear a whale. Ships have to clear a wide path. So this reduces ship strikes, which are a major cause of whale death. It's probably going to be the turning point, the tipping point that will save some populations of whales. It's pretty amazing when you think about it. Simply by singing, a whale can turn aside a huge tanker. These ships are, of course, bigger than entire office towers.
Skyscrapers.
And so, yeah, skyscrapers. And so essentially we've built whale lanes in the ocean that override shipping lanes. And that, especially if we scale it up, and they are doing that in Hawaii with turtles, in Australia with tuna, we're going to have a lot more protection in the ocean for endangered species.
And this is real-time data, which is huge because you want compliance and you want accurate locations.
That's right. So not only is it real-time data, it's way more accurate because underwater, it's hard to see these whales, but we know exactly where they are when we're listening to them. That also applies on land. In the forest, you can only see an animal if it's walking down the path, but if you're listening, you can hear it hiding in the bushes. By the way, scientists have used bioacoustics in this manner to discover entirely new species by hearing the sounds they're making. They discovered an entirely new population of blue whales in the Indian Ocean. Mm. And they also have been able to find species that they thought had gone extinct, but are still there. They're hiding, but we can hear them. And if we know where they are, we can do a better job at protecting them.
Digital innovations. Scientist and geography professor at University of British Columbia, Karen Bakker, stays with us on how these digital technologies allow us to eavesdrop on the ongoing hidden communication across the natural world, the ethical tensions around that. Still time to talk. 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We explore how digital technologies are transforming our ability to listen to nature's sounds and decode non-human communication. Geographer Karen Bakker's new book is called The Sounds of Life, and she wants us to imagine these digital devices working like a planetary-scale hearing aid and enabling us to observe and study nature's soundscape beyond the limits of our own capabilities. Join in, 800-642-1234, and Karen Bakker stays with us. Karen, take us to coral reefs, where scientists are doing more than listening. They're beginning to listen to entire ecosystems. What recordings are being made of coral reefs?
So for a long time, not much of this work was done on coral reefs, and where it was done on fish. So fish actually make a whole bunch of noise. Shrimp, click their little pincers. So the recent breakthrough, though, has been on coral itself. Now, coral larvae are very tiny, microscopic creatures. They're basically blobs covered with hair, to use non-scientific terminology. The
I
hairs
like
are
it. I
called,
like it.
yeah, the hairs are called cilia, for anyone who's interested. And they don't have a central nervous system. So the assumption was these are simply pretty, helpless beings. Coral larvae are born at these mass spawning events. They're very beautiful. They're like underwater fireworks. They all wash out to sea, which is a protective for them, so they aren't eaten by predators. They grow in the open ocean, and then they eventually drift back to reefs and settle. And scientists thought that was completely random. You just get pushed around by the ocean currents, the wind, the waves. But in the past couple of years, they've started doing experiments on coral larvae and the ability of coral larvae to hear sound. And it turns out that coral larvae are exquisitely sensitive to sound. They can not only distinguish the sound of a reef from other sound, they can distinguish between an unhealthy reef and a healthy reef. And get this, they can even pick out the sound of their home reef from other reef sounds, and they swim back towards their home reef. Scientists don't know how, but somehow at the moment of their birth, they are sonically imprinting on the sounds of their home, a bit like a coral lullaby. They get washed out to sea for a couple miles, and remember, no arms, no legs, no ears, these little blobs, they somehow swim back home in order to settle. And if creatures like coral larvae are that attuned to sound, it probably means that everything in nature, every living organism, has some capacity to sense and respond to sound.
Well, let's listen to a couple of recordings of coral reef systems. These are made by Bernie Krause from the University of Michigan. And first, this is a dying reef. Okay, and now a healthy reef system here. And so, what differences do you hear, Karen?
Yeah, so the healthy reef has a very rich and full acoustic soundscape. The term soundscape is the collection of sounds made by a landscape. And what you get when the reef is degraded, or any soundscape is degraded, is you have fewer sounds at a reduced range of frequencies. You basically break the beat, the rhythm of the reef, and you make that soundscape a lot simpler. In fact, scientists make pictures of what we just heard, and you can kind of read those pictures, much like a radiologist would read an X-ray or an MRI scan. And just by looking at it, you can see, oh, that species is no longer present because that the acoustic niche they occupied is no longer there. So climate change, which is one of the major sources of reef death, is actually silencing the oceans. The one silver lining is that scientists have also found that you can use healthy reef sound a bit like music therapy. They call it acoustic enrichment. If you play the sounds of healthy reefs on those degraded reefs, fish and coral larvae will come to check it out, and they will recolonize the reef, and you can actually help it become healthy again. So acoustic enrichment is now an idea that scientists are trying with lots of different species to see if it might be helpful for them. Music therapy for nature, why not?
Could that music therapy, though, actually repair coral systems? Because we've seen the bleached coral. Does it have the ability to repair?
So what it does is it allows a new generation of fish and coral larvae to settle. It doesn't bring back the dead coral. It essentially, you can think of it kind of like a triage. In the world where most of our coral reefs are likely to vanish, scientists are in a race against time to save a few. And on those few, they're trying to save music therapy can be very beneficial. Mm. And so it's the tragedy is still unfolding, and this is not going to solve the problem for all the reefs in the world, but it might help us save the few that we're desperately trying to save.
Let's land on plants, because you write about how plants possess memory, they anticipate events, even communicate with other plants and with animals. Karen, how is this possible?
So we have long known that plants communicate biochemically. Trees can summon wasps, for example. And the work of Suzanne Simard at the University of British Columbia has shown beautifully, beautiful science, how biochemicals can actually transmit messages. Trees share nutrients through their roots. Acoustic communication is something that has been less well studied, but it is a branch of science. It's called phytoacoustics. And we've learned that plants emit sound. So corn seedlings, for example, emit sound in an ultrasonic frequency that we cannot hear, but animals can. Yossi Yovel in Tel Aviv has done amazing experiments with tomatoes. Depending on whether the tomato is dehydrated or the plant has been cut or stressed, it will emit sounds, and those sounds are different. They then trained an AI algorithm to recognize those sounds. The AI algorithm can tell you if your tomato is dehydrated or not, stressed or not, because it can hear the ultrasonic sound that these plants are emitting. Now, of course, the question is, what does this really mean? Is there any significance? I'm not pretending that this language has symbolic content in the way that we understand human language, but it certainly conveys ecologically relevant information. One more example, Heidi Appel at the University of Toledo did an amazing experiment. She played the sounds of insects chewing on leaves to a very simple plant, Eridopsis thaliana. It's a model organism in biology. The plant could distinguish between white noise, music, and the sound of insects chomping. It only released its defensive chemicals when it heard those insects. And then she did another experiment where she played two types of insects chomping, one dangerous to that plant, one that was not a predator of that plant. And the plants only responded to the sound of the insect that was their specific predator. They are exquisitely attuned to sounds in nature to know what's a threat and what's not. And they have little hairs, in this case, all over their leaves called trichomes. And those hairs are like cilia, just like the cilia in your ear that are responding to the sounds that I'm making right now. Mm. And that's what they use to hear. That's what the plants use to pick up these sounds.
Oh, Karen, so much to explore. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me, and people can tune in on the NPR Science Friday Book Club in November. This book, The Sounds of Life, is Science Friday's book club selection for November. We're starting next week, and people can read along.
Karen Bakker, author of The Sounds of Life, How Digital Technology is Bringing Us Closer to the World of Animals and Plants, teaches at the University of British Columbia, fellow at the Harvard Radcliffe Institute for Advanced Study. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. Thank you.